Thanks, Phil, and thank you so much for coming out. I know it's a windy and blustery Friday night, and I'm really glad that you're here. As we start thinking about the question of suffering, I think it's a really important thing that we just recognize here in this room, we are coming and asking this question in a few different ways. For some of us, it will just feel like an interesting sort of question, something you'd like to think about. Not something that feels very urgent or very painful just now, just it's an interesting question, and maybe that's why you're here. For others of us, though, it will be because it's a much more pressing question that you might just now, or someone who you love, be going through some very intense suffering. And for you, it feels like a very different sort of question. Now, with lots of us here tonight, some of us will be in at least one of those camps. As we talk together, particularly as we do a question and answer, I really hope that we can serve you well, whatever it is that you're bringing to this conversation tonight. It might be that asking a question publicly, it might be coming and chatting to me afterwards. If that would help, we'd love to do that. Also, as we start to ask this question, I think it's worth recognizing that thinking about suffering in St. Albans in 2020 has a certain kind of feel to it. How do we encounter suffering? Well, in some ways, I suppose, we experience it very immediately, don't we, through our screens. We are barraged on our televisions, on our phones, with famines and floodings and bombings and tsunamis and pandemics. That's a slightly strange way to experience suffering, isn't it? It's very immediate to us. It's very visible. It's hard to turn off. It's constantly there. And there are apocalyptic scenes almost daily around the world. But it's also something very distant from us. This is what is happening around the world and actually nowhere near us. This is suffering which we have no real part of. That feels a little strange, I guess, for lots of us. It can make some of us feel pretty guilty about the comfort that we enjoy. Can make lots of us just pretty fearful because the world out there is in a real mess. So that's one way that we experience suffering and encounter it here in St. Albans. But there are other sorts of suffering as well, aren't there? We've seen in recent times an explosion in issues of anxiety and depression, even suicide in our own culture. And many of us will have been touched by some of those things. In many ways, those are much less hard to see, aren't they? They're not there on the television screen. They are behind the scenes. You wouldn't know it, perhaps, to look at any of us tonight, to know how we're suffering in some of those ways. There's an author named Melissa Broder who brought out a book a couple of years ago called So Sad Today. She describes her experience like this. I wake up scared. And I'm scared all day, scared of not being able to function, scared that others will discover I'm not only imperfect, I'm not even okay. But most people who meet me never know that I'm struggling. On the outside, I'm smiling. I'm juggling all the balls of okayness, emotional, mental, spiritual, existential. Underneath, though, I'm suffocating. Maybe something like that resonates with you, frantically juggling all the balls of okayness, really a little afraid of what you might let slip, what other people might glimpse about what's really going on underneath. So there are a couple of ways that life in St. Albans in 2020 might frame this question for us. The suffering that we see out there, very immediate in some ways on the screens, the suffering that goes on in many of our lives that's very unseen. It's also worth, I think, recognizing that we come to this from some other broader perspectives. For one thing, it's helpful, I think, to realize that it is somewhat unusual to think that suffering is an objection to believing in God. That's what many people assume today, isn't it? That suffering disproves that God could really be there. It's worth recognizing that we are out of step then with most of the world. Because most of the world has no trouble. The parts of the world, indeed, very often that suffer very terribly, have no trouble in holding on to a belief in God. We actually find in large parts of the world that in the face of suffering, they turn to God and not away from God. That should give us some pause, I think. Then we should recognize that we're also out of step with a fair bit of the history of our own country as well, to think that suffering somehow doesn't fit with belief. Because for centuries in our own country, people have believed in God, even though their lives were far harder, far shorter than ours. In those long centuries before penicillin, before paracetamol, people were believing in God in far greater numbers than they do today. We assume that somehow the existence of suffering makes it harder to believe in God. And many places in the world and many parts of human history say that's not necessarily so. We also, I think, ought to recognize that we live in a culture that is very afraid of suffering. A culture that cherishes comfort. I've been reading a book recently that's trying to understand why are so many young people anxious and depressed today. One of the things that the authors want to highlight is a whole generation who have been reared by overprotective parents. Parents who have wanted to try and shield their children from any kind of harm or suffering. And so they've not developed any resilience for it. They go off to university and suddenly hit real crises. We live in a generation that, at least many of us who are younger, live in a generation that cherishes comfort and has been very carefully protected from hardship. And that sets us apart from other generations, former generations for whom suffering and hardship were something to be embraced, something as character-forming, something that might make us stronger rather than crush us. It's kind of interesting that we have moved away from that. So a few things that I think is worth pointing out at the start, things that we're going to come back to, that just frame this question for us, ways in which we approach it. Now, for the rest of the time, what I want to do is to try and give you a window on how Christians think about this question, how we think about the problem of suffering. And to do that, I'm going to use one of the most famous prayers in the Bible. It's the prayer that Jesus taught to his disciples, the Lord's Prayer. I think it's going to be a helpful framework to try and think, why does God allow suffering and how does a Christian answer that? The first thing I want to underline for you, as we put it up on the screen there, is that Christians have questions about suffering too. Of course we do. Christians, in fact, especially have questions about suffering. And you can see why, because Jesus teaches us to pray to our Father in heaven. Christians believe there is a Father in heaven who is somehow in charge. So of course we have questions about suffering. I think that's a helpful place to start. Because many of us will assume, perhaps, that you don't become a Christian until you've got all of your questions answered. You might be thinking, I've got a list of questions and all of these would need to be answered before I could even think about becoming a Christian. But that is not how it works. Becoming a Christian is much more like being adopted into a family so that you can call God your father. Or it's like getting married. Now, in both of those situations, you're not going to arrive at the point where all of your questions are answered, are they? If you're thinking about entering into a family, you're going to have some questions. You're going to want to know what this family is like. But it's much more about getting to know them and spending time with them and thinking, do I know enough to trust them? It's the same when you get married. You sensibly would want to ask a few questions as you get to know somebody, thinking whether you might marry them. There are some basic questions you think, are we going to agree? Do we like the same kind of music? Do they feel the same way that I do about mushrooms? There are some key basic questions you want to ask. But you're not going to go about that thinking, I've got a whole list and I need all of my questions answered before I'm going to enter into this relationship. It's just not how it works. What you do is you get far enough to think, I know enough to know I can trust them. And then you commit. Then you enter into a relationship with them. You formalize that adoption or you make the proposal. The relationship begins. Now, very often, of course, the big questions are going to come afterwards, aren't they? That's how marriage certainly works. Really, the big questions come on the inside. Now that I know this person, you start to have those sorts of questions. When I got married 14 years ago, I knew some things about my wife. I knew a fair bit about my wife, but I didn't know everything. Thankfully, she didn't know everything about me. There were plenty of things. I worked very, very hard at a fair few bad habits that I kept well hidden at least 6 months in before she started to see what I was really like. Now, look, I think that's a helpful way to think about what it is to be a Christian. We are those who call God a Father in heaven, but we are not those who feel like every question for us has been answered. That means if you're sitting here with someone who is who's invited you, someone who's a Christian, then you could turn to them and find out what questions they have about suffering. They will have questions. The difference between you and them is not that you've got loads of questions and they have none. The difference is you both have questions about suffering. They have found someone they can trust, someone who they can talk to about them. That's what it is to be a Christian. We believe we have a Father in heaven to talk to about these things. Okay, how does the prayer go on? Let's move on. The next few lines in the Lord's Prayer. Hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Here's what I want you to notice. Christians know that things on earth are a mess. The whole thrust of this prayer is that we are asking that God would come and put the world right. His will is done in heaven, but it is not done on earth. And so we are asking that God would come and fix it, that his kingdom would come. Now, in the Bible, when we hear about God's kingdom, we're talking about God's promise that one day he will come and put an end to all suffering. The Bible speaks beautifully about what that day will be like. Speaks about a day when the eyes of the blind will be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped, when the lame will leap like a deer and the mute tongue will sing for joy. In another place in the Bible, it says that God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. The Bible contains this amazing promise that God is one day going to put the world right. But we know, as Christians, that we are not there yet. That things right now are in a mess. And that we can talk about them. And we can pray that God would come and fix those things. Now, the really important thing that that means for us is that Jesus invites us then to name all the things that are wrong in the world. We don't have to ignore that they're not, that they're there. Cancer and rape, greed and genocide, racism, sexism, every kind of abuse. Jesus knows that those things are wrong. He agrees with us that they are horribly wrong. That's really important because we do feel the wrongness of those things, don't we? We know that the world is in a mess. It's what makes this whole question a powerful question. If God is loving, then how could he allow these things? Because they feel to us to be so wrong. As we said at the start, for lots of people, that would feel like an objection to becoming a Christian. How could I believe that? It's one of the reasons I am so glad I am a Christian. Because it allows me to say, these things are wrong. If I was an atheist, I wouldn't be able to say that. I might want to say that, but I would have no right to say that all of those things we've just listed are themselves wrong. There are a few atheists, like someone like Richard Dawkins, who are honest enough to admit that. He very famously puts it this way, that the universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect. If there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. No design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. The universe is blind. It doesn't think those things are wrong. Nobody sees it. Nobody cares. If the whole cosmos is, as some people think, just the chance collision of atoms and the outworking of natural processes, then there is really no difference between the death of a child and a sunrise. One is not tragic. One is not beautiful. They just are. There is no problem with suffering. You cannot have a problem with suffering. It's just the way the world is. If anything, it's positive on an evolutionary basis, because Then the weak die, and our tribes survive, and the human race evolves. One of the reasons I love being a Christian is it allows me to say those things are wrong. It should not be this way. Well, think of some of the other options that people might turn to. Something like Buddhism, say, or Stoicism. A couple of the great options that people have thought, if we're going to wrestle with suffering, we might try these. And they are some improvement on what we've said already. They at least acknowledge that there is a problem with suffering, and they're offering you some way to deal with it. But all that they suggest, Buddhism and Stoicism together, they say, all you really need to do is detach yourself. Rise above it. Anything or anyone that causes you pain, find a way to distance yourself from it. Or simply resign yourself to suffering. It's inevitable. All you can control is how much you complain about it. So remarkable, I was reading this week, the early Greek philosophers who took this idea described us as dogs tied to the back of a cart. We are being dragged along by the universe. And our only decision is how much we whine and complain about it. They said, accept your lot, get on with it, don't complain. I've just started watching the Netflix series Afterlife. It's that Ricky Gervais drama about a man who loses his wife to cancer. And he is terrifically sad. He is lost in his grief. The episode I watched last night, he went to his counselor, his therapist. And his therapist went with this sort of approach. The guy said, I just want to stop feeling sad. And all the therapist said would, go on then, stop feeling sad. It was all he had to offer him in the face of terrible suffering. But the Christian has a reason to say that suffering is wrong, and a reason to respond the way that we all want to, with questions. Why is it like this? With tears. This is wrong. Jesus teaches us in this prayer to say the world is not as it should be. He invites your questions. He also, though, hints at why the world is this way. Here's how the prayer goes on. Give us today our daily bread. Forgive us our sins, for we also forgive everyone who sins against us. If there is a one-word answer to why the world is in such a mess, then it would be that little word, sin. It's the truth that human beings have turned away from God and started serving themselves, deciding that instead of doing God's will and pursuing his kingdom, instead we are going to pursue our own wills and set up our own kingdoms. Now, the first book of the Bible tells that story, and it helps us understand why there is so much suffering in the world. There is so much suffering in the world because of us. Now, it seems to me that I think we're waking up to that more and more. That so many of those natural disasters that we see on the news actually have human selfishness and greed at the heart of them. Houses built on floodplains because there is more profit in it, and who cares if they get hurt? Or corrupt governments who fail to make provision in times of drought and so spark famines. Authorities who would rather save face than make known a problem with a potential pandemic. We suffer because of sin in the world. Sometimes that will be because of our own sin, the things that we do wrong, the ways that we pursue our own wills and our own kingdoms, sometimes because of the way that other people have acted. Well, there's more to the story, though, than that. The Bible teaches us that God's loving response to our sin, trying to set up our own little kingdoms, is to show us that that cannot work and that cannot last. He won't let us set up those pretend kingdoms and pursue our selfish wills. And so he sends warnings, reminders that we are not in charge. We are not the kings and queens we like to make ourselves out to be. And so death in the Bible is that great warning that your kingdom will not last, that God is in charge. It is, as the Bible says, God's judgment against our sin, our turning away from him. And that means that every experience of suffering, every experience of death, is a reminder to us of how we have turned away from God. Now, it might be that you are experiencing, even now, the consequences of your own decisions, your own selfish actions. I want to say, listen to that. Let it speak to you. It is not pointless. It is not nothing. It is, in fact, an invitation. The same invitation that's here in the Lord's Prayer. Come and ask for forgiveness. Recognize that that is how you have lived. And recognize that our lives revolving around ourselves in all sorts of petty and selfish ways has contributed to the world's mess. And come and say sorry, and come and be forgiven. Suffering can speak to us in other ways too, though. Even when we're not responsible for the sin and the suffering that we are experiencing. That would be the story of Joy Davidman. Joy Davidman was the woman who would later go on to marry C.S. Lewis. Her first marriage, though, was much less happy. She was married to a man who was a workaholic, an alcoholic, someone who was unfaithful to her. He would go missing from time to time and abandon the family. There was one night when he'd gone missing, and she was frantically trying to find out where he was while putting the children to bed. And then in the silence that followed, she describes what happened next. She said, "For the first time in my life, I felt helpless. For the first time, my pride was forced to admit that I was not, after all, the master of my fate and the captain of my soul. All my defenses, all the walls of arrogance and cocksureness and self-love behind which I'd hid from God, all those defenses went down momentarily, and God came in." It's an experience of suffering, nothing that she was responsible for, but it was an experience of suffering that said, "I cannot do this on my own. I am not the one who can hold my life together." It's a reminder that we are creatures and not the Creator. We are made in God's image, but we are not God, able to preserve our own lives and hold everything together. And so as her second husband, C.S. Lewis, would say, God whispers to us in our pleasures. He speaks to us in our conscience, but he shouts to us in our pain. It's his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. But notice what the message is. What is God saying to us? It is not a word of condemnation. Here is an invitation to call God our Father and to know that we can be forgiven and brought back. The Christian Bible speaks about how God even sent his Son into the world to make that possible. Death is God's judgment on our sin. But through Jesus taking our place, we can be forgiven, brought into his family, free to call him Father, free to ask him for his forgiveness, free to ask him to meet our daily needs, recognizing we can't meet them for ourselves. Now, that last little phrase in the prayer helps us see what difference all of this makes. Jesus teaches his followers to pray, "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one." Here's what I want you to notice about that phrase. What does this prayer say that we need protecting from? Jesus is not inviting us to pray for protection from suffering. Instead, don't let us fall into selfishness and sin. Now, do you see how opposite that is to what we would ask God for, what our culture would ask God for? We would much rather be able to do everything that I want, to pursue my own will and never to suffer. That's what I would choose. That's the dream, isn't it? Do what we want and do it in comfort. Even more, it's what we want for our kids. We want them to be able to pursue their dreams and to never get hurt. But that is a pipe dream. It is another cause of so much anxiety today, as we were saying earlier on. We are terrified of suffering, and so we often cotton wool our families, trying to protect them, thinking that if we get them into the right schools and the right universities, if they meet the right person, then they'll be safe. But it is such a naive way of thinking, because of course in this world they will suffer. And so to make that our prayer, to say, let them pursue their dreams and never suffer, is utterly unrealistic. It is also a pretty self-centered way to think about the world, isn't it? We have a generation of kids who've grown up on Disney movies and have been taught that the great commandment is to go live your dreams. Be true to yourself. This above all, to thine own self be true. Go and make and create yourself. But what I'd love us to see from this prayer is how Jesus' way is much, much better. Jesus calls us to be much more concerned about selfishness than suffering. He teaches us to pray that we would not fall into the temptation of serving ourselves, of chasing our dreams and trying to impose our will on the world. Instead, he calls us to follow his example, resisting that temptation to serve myself and instead embracing a life of serving others, laying down our lives even for others. Now that is going to be painful. That is going to call us out of our comfort zone. It is going to call for sacrifices of my time and my energy and my money. It hurts. It is uncomfortable to follow Jesus. And so in some ways, this is the most countercultural thing I'll say tonight. I've said that suffering is painful and we shouldn't pretend it isn't. I expect most of us agree with that. I've said that suffering in the world is caused by human pride and selfishness. And I guess we could easily point to a lot of things that would agree with that too. But Jesus' prayer says something very controversial indeed. It says the best life you could live in this broken world is one where you embrace suffering, where you choose suffering for the sake of others, that you stop worshipping the God of comfort and start saying no to your own desires and wishes. How can Jesus say that? If he is a good person to follow, if we have a good Father in heaven, how could he not want to protect his people from suffering? Well, a few things on that as we close. First of all, suffering can have a positive outcome. It can be fruitful in our lives. As we said at the start, I think as a culture we've lost the sense of that. But it is more blessed to give than to receive. Jesus said that. He lived it out. Second, Jesus doesn't want to protect his followers from all suffering, because he wants his people to get stuck into the mess of the world and to help, rather than staying in our own safe bubble. Again, Jesus lived that out. And then third, Jesus can ask us to embrace suffering now because of that kingdom of God that we talked about earlier. It is coming. The great promise of the Bible is that suffering will one day come to an end. Remember that promise, he will wipe away every tear from our eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. The Christian is free to pray this prayer, to ask God to turn us away from our own selfishness, because we are not afraid of suffering. It can take nothing away from us that God won't give back. And so we can trust him with our questions, with our lives.